I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Covering the Republican and Democratic conventions these past 2 weeks meant listening to a lot of speeches. If you tuned in to any of the proceedings, you saw it too, a parade of speakers marching up to the podium to preach to the faithful. Who was the most effective? Did anything you heard make you rethink your position? Today we look at the strategies used to build a voter base and learn what makes a message succeed or fail by decoding the political rhetoric. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, we just finished two national political conventions, and that means we all heard a whole lot of words. President Barack Obama and Governor Mitt Romney delivered two generally well-regarded acceptance speeches, but dozens of other speakers addressed delegates as well, one after another, over and over again. I should know because I was there. But which party and which speakers were the most effective? Who got their points across? Who proved to be the most persuasive? We'll get a rundown this morning as we decode all the political rhetoric of 2012. With us today again is Dr. Robert Rowland. He's a professor of communication studies at KU, and he specializes in political rhetoric. He's worked with 9 candidates for Congress on developing persuasive messages. He was last on this show in 2009. And Robin, so good to have you back again.
It's great to be here, Steve.
Well, a lot of speakers just threw a whole lot of words at voters the past 2 weeks. Polls show that, you know, both parties appeared to have gotten bounces coming out of their conventions, and President Obama today, at least, once again has regained a small lead. Any general thoughts here, Robin, on which party made the most effective use of language the last couple of weeks?
Well, I think it seems clear that the Democrats have gotten a bigger bounce than the Republicans did.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that across the board, the Democrats had an awfully good convention. There were any number of really effective speeches. One of the things I noticed was that Democrats are really much more unified, I think, than people thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thinking was that the Republicans were very unified and the Democrats were pretty apathetic. I didn't see that at the convention across the board. And I think Clinton and Michelle Obama and the president were all very effective. I thought the Republican convention, I think the two dominant messages that they're trying to get across were that Obama has failed,
mm-hmm.
and that they tried to humanize Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they hit those two messages very hard. And there were some very good speeches. I thought that Marco Rubio's speech was very good. And I thought that the ordinary people who had experience with Romney, they were very good. Now, those were not on the major networks. They were not in prime time.
Yeah, you know, I thought the efforts to humanize Mitt Romney were very effective, that he really ended up coming across as more of a human being than at least I'd seen him before. And Ann Romney's speech got to that, and so did his speech as well.
I think that's exactly right.
Right.
They spent a lot more time on that than they did than he did laying out a policy roadmap for the future.
Hey, how good, just in general, do you think the two main speeches were, Robin? I'm talking about the acceptance speeches by the president himself and Governor Romney.
Well, I think Romney is clearly running on the idea that the economy is bad enough that if he can humanize himself, he'll win, because his acceptance speech was an unusual lack of detail for a challenger. I went back and compared it to Reagan in 1980, because Reagan's kind of a hallmark we compare anybody against because he was so good. And Reagan was much, much more detailed than Romney was. So I think that's what Romney's betting things on. I think the consensus is that Clinton had the best speech at the Democratic convention,
mm-hmm.
and Michelle Obama very close. I personally thought that the president's speech was the best speech because it was more thematic than Bill Clinton's speech was. And I am a little bit skeptical that the public as a whole follows the details of the arguments in quite the way that Bill Clinton expressed them. Yeah. But you know, he's an awfully effective guy.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing, as you just mentioned, that really struck me was considering what the country's up against right now with the deficit, with all sorts of issues, that the president and Mitt Romney, neither one of them really said very much about, here's what I'm going to do once I get in office. They sort of outlined broad policy goals, but that's one thing. In terms of exactly what they're going to do, I didn't hear a whole lot of, I guess, specificity is the word I'm thinking about.
I think that's especially true for Romney. I think they were almost wishes more than even goals.
Great word for it.
You know, everybody hopes we can create 12 million jobs in 4 years. That's 250,000 a month. That would be awfully fast economic growth. The president's in a little bit different situation because he has 4 years of record. He didn't lay out new initiatives in any detail. Mm-hmm. I think their original campaign plan was to run if the economy had gotten stronger, as it appeared to do in January and February, I think they were going to run, like Reagan in 84, It's Morning Again in America campaign. And I think but they can't because the economy didn't get that much better. So I think the president speech was basically, it's about to be morning again in America. Mm-hmm. And I just went back through it. You know, he's relatively specific on defending things he's either already proposed or things he won't do. Mm-hmm. In fact, one thing that hasn't gotten much notice is he said he came out for the general principles of the debt commission. And I hadn't seen him say – he'd praised the commission before, but not at that level of specificity. What that tells you is that he's comfortable with about a 2-to-1 cuts in or reforms of entitlements versus raising additional revenue.
Well, I really can't ask you go much farther without asking you about one speaker, Clint Eastwood, that everyone is still talking about. The story in the paper yesterday, just – I tipped over my bowl of cornflakes reading it. He's talking about the fact that he didn't prepare anything before he walked out in that stage, or virtually nothing. Came out with just a few minutes of preparation and let that thing rip, and it sure looked like it.
Yeah, it was an awkward moment, and it was awkward for the Romney campaign because it kind of overshadowed Romney's speech in the media coverage of it. Mm-hmm. But I think the other thing is it really – there were parts of that presentation that were quite disrespectful to the president, implying that the president would use a vulgarity if he were talking about Romney. And, you know, that kind of – I mean, I find that as a rhetorician, I find that a dangerous trend in American rhetoric, regardless of what party. I just mm-hmm. think we ought to be respectful of the office. And the same thing would apply to Democrats when George W. Bush was president.
Well, I guess this brings up a point, which is that no matter how experienced you are in front of people, Clint Eastwood, myself, anybody, I guess you sort of – preparation is sort of part of the ballgame. At least that's how I've always understood. I don't come in here unless I got a few notes in front of me and know where I want to take a conversation. Even Clint Eastwood might have benefited from a little more prep, it seems to me.
Well, he's benefited from having scripts in the past.
Yeah.
And I'll just say Reagan practiced. As soon as you know that Reagan practiced, you know that it is always sensible to practice for anything that's important.
That's key.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Again, we're talking this morning about the two political conventions and all the speeches we heard. Which ones were the most persuasive? Which speakers really cut through most effectively? We're interested in your 2 cents on all of that. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. We're visiting with Dr. Robin Rowland, who's a professor of communication studies over at KU. Well, Professor, you know, as an expert in political rhetoric, how do you judge the effectiveness of any one political speech? What do you look for?
Well, I mean, obviously the gold standard is moving public opinion.
Yeah.
you know, in many cases, it's very hard to tell about moving public opinion because you don't have good data, or if you have polls, the polls are influenced by a variety of other factors. And at that point, you really look to see if the person is adapting to the situation as effectively as they can. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a lot of people have talked about Obama's favorability rating at about 50%, which is not a sign that he's failing in this instance, given the economy. It's a sign that he must be doing pretty well in how he's persuading things. And I compare Obama.
Explain that to me. How can he be under 50% and still be effective at how he's persuading?
It is really hard to sell your message when the economy is not going strong. Mm-hmm. In 1981 and 1982, it appeared that Reagan would either not be renominated or that he would lose in a landslide. The great communicator was not so great in 81 and 82. It was his message began to resonate only after the economy started to come back.
So that's what it takes, you know, in Obama's case, perhaps. If things begin to lift, people will buy what he's selling a whole lot more.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And and I think the other thing that's important is Obama has been a little bit more successful than Reagan was in moving public opinion when he's made an effort. I think notably on the debt ceiling – after the debt – on the debt ceiling issue, he tried to move public opinion to strongly favor his proposal, which is to raise more revenue by increasing taxes on people making over $250,000 a year. And he won that debate in public opinion with, in most polls, about 60 or 58 or 62%. But the difference is, for a variety of reasons, national public opinion does not make much difference in the House of Representatives now. Mm-hmm. Gerrymandering, very, very few seats are really in the mix. And so he was able to move public opinion more last year than Reagan was in 81. But Reagan had a lot bigger impact because it was a different political situation.
So then if you don't have polls to measure it by, if the economy is not going well enough for Obama to sort of ride that pony for a while, then how do you evaluate exactly if a speech cuts through or whether it doesn't, Professor?
Well, two things. I mean, you look at every measure you can find of public opinion. So you look at editorials. There are people who do look at Twitter feed, they look at social networking sites, and they look at but you also compare what the person has done to the political situation, to the rhetorical situation. You know, and if Obama were not pretty effective, his polling numbers would be much worse than they are now. His polling, given the economy, I think, you know, especially his favorability, it's astonishing how high it is given the economy.
How about independent evaluations that sort of run, you know, forgetting all the rest of it, just reading a speech and marking the words that sort of resonated with people and that kind of thing?
This may seem self-serving, but I think you need to have some training in how rhetoric works.
Right.
And I see commentators all over the mark. I'm thinking of the moment after Obama spoke after the Iowa caucuses, in which David Brooks predicted that he would be shocked if Obama didn't sweep the rest of the primaries. And of course, Obama then went on to immediately lose in New Hampshire. and you see Obama being criticized on two sides of the New York Times op-ed page. I mean, Maureen Dowd says he's lost his ability to inspire, and Tom Friedman says he has not proposed anything big. If liberal commentators can't even agree on his sins, I think it tells you, first, that what Obama is doing is very, very hard. Mm-hmm. You know, again, Reagan had a lot of trouble, and if Reagan couldn't do it, you know, my kind of rule of thumb is if Reagan couldn't do it, then no one could do it because he really was that good.
You know, one thing that strikes me about these conventions anymore, just speaking broadly about both conventions, is that, you know, these things are so incredibly well scripted these days, Robin. The speeches are focus grouped, lines are tested. It almost seems to me it's almost next to impossible to sort of concoct a convention these days and plan as much as you do to pull one off and not come out with some success when it comes to a bounce in the polls, because the whole thing, everything is tailor-made to achieve that one specific result.
I think that's right. But I think you also have to add in that, you know, rhetorical skill and coming across as authentically who you are still makes a lot of difference. Remember, in 2004, when Obama spoke, he was a state senator running for the United States Senate.
That's right.
And it is literally true that 19 minutes later, the speech is about 18 and a half, commentators on the cable networks were beginning to speculate that he is a potential future president of the United States. Mm. You know, and think about Reagan's speech for Goldwater. In 64, effective rhetoric can change things. And there were, like I say, some very good examples, especially in the Democratic Convention, although Marco Rubio, I thought his speech was really good. And I thought the ordinary people speaking about Romney, that was very touching. And Ann Romney's speech, I thought was – you know, Ryan's speech was good until the fact-checking.
Yes. And then all kinds of problems there. We'll talk about facts and their importance in just a couple of minutes. Again, if you're just joining us, we're talking about persuasive speeches at our two national political conventions the last couple of weeks. Which speeches to you sort of cut through? Which speeches fell a little bit short? Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Paul from Overland Park, good morning.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest about President Obama's speech, watching this, and he's constantly switching from looking to his left and his right, and he's asking whoever his audience was to vote for him, and, you know, and I assume the people at the convention were going to be doing that anyway, and, you know, not looking directly at the camera, or very infrequently, and... I don't know. How did he interpret that, or did he consider that at all? It seems to me like, you know, like I watch local news presentations, and I'll cut the sound, and I just watch the head shaking and so forth, you know. And so it's like a little theater production. And anyway, that was my question about what his professional reaction was to the continual swinging from left to right, and yet he's addressing the audience in the country, which is, you know, basically this camera in front of him.
Paul, that's such a good question because I noticed exactly the same thing, that the different skill levels when it came to using the teleprompter, some looking straight ahead at the words projected out in front of them and speaking to the audience in a sense, others swinging back and forth from left to right. And then, to be honest, Governor Kathleen Sebelius getting up there and really struggling with the idea of reading a text off the teleprompter. I thought it was very obvious. How tough is it to pull that off and use a teleprompter, Robin?
Well, apparently, until you get the hang of it, it's awfully tough. And I do think that delivery matters at the margin. Bill Clinton, I think, is the example of somebody who put an awful lot of passion into what he said.
No kidding.
And there were several others. I mean, the less important speeches. Ted Strickland, I thought, was very good at the Democratic Convention. I still think it's the ideas that matter most. Maybe mm-hmm. I'm the last optimist who thinks that really it's the battle of ideas that in the end is the most important thing.
You're saying it's the words themselves as opposed to how they're delivered.
I think that's right.
Boy, to me, how you're delivering those words matters a whole lot.
Well, I think it shows.
And again, Governor Sebelius, is an example of that. I think she really struggled up there.
Well, she has trouble expressing passion.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get somebody who can who's comfortable doing that, I think it's the ideas that matter most.
She always struck me as so interesting because she is the daughter of a governor. She was raised in the family of a governor. And my experience has always suggested that, you know, folks like that, when they're raised under those strict confines of always being in the public eye, you know, she is kind of tightly strapped down, kind of a public persona, and you don't see passion coming out of her in a way that Bill Clinton does, for example, two completely different speakers.
Yeah, there's another idea about being comfortable in your own skin.
Yeah.
And having a rhetorical authenticity of always sounding like who you are. And that, in my standard, again, is President Reagan, who always sounded like who he is, who he was. And I think the president's that way. And I think being heavily involved in your own speech writing is mm-hmm. absolutely essential for that.
Mm-hmm. Can you teach that? When to what extent can you teach delivery? Can you teach authenticity? Or is it just a matter of practice, or do some people have it and some people don't?
I think mostly it's some people have it and some people don't. If you could teach charisma, Democrats would have done that with Al Gore, and he would have been president. It's authenticity, it's passion, it's charisma. You know, you can help somebody. You can definitely help somebody, make them a lot better, but you can't teach what Bill Clinton does.
I mentioned in the intro that you've worked with 9 candidates for Congress on developing persuasive messages. Tell us about that. How do you go about that, and what process do you use with these candidates to sort of bring them up to speed in a way?
Well, I mean, my principle is you always have to start with sensible arguments about the policies. That if campaigns are not sensible arguments about ideas, then they're not doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, that's my background in argumentation and debate. I want things to make sense.
So you got to have that first. Then I assume, secondly, you've got to have a well-written speech of some kind.
You do. And so you then start thinking about how you weave the policies into larger themes. And then you want to make sure you find the candidate's authentic voice, because it's no good if they sound like me. They need to sound like them.
How do you do that?
Well, you have to get to know the candidate. I mean, I think one of the difficulties in all this is that campaign speeches are often written by essentially a committee.
Yes.
And sometimes you'll also get kind of consultant speak. And I think consultants can be very good, but I think you want to find the voice of the candidate.
The voice of the candidate, meaning that if someone talks like, gosh, golly, that's, you know, and they use phrases like that, you want to incorporate those phrases in whatever speech they're giving.
Yeah, the best example is Sarah Palin. I mean, that's the last time a convention speech really moved the needle. After Sarah Palin spoke 4 years ago, there was a period of about a week where McCain was ahead beyond the margin of error. That speech really changed things.
Why was she so effective?
Well, she came across as who she was, and she was brand new to the stage. It was
a pleasant surprise for a lot of people listening to that speech.
Yeah, not to Democrats.
When you
read David Plouffe's book about it, it's quite clear that she made Democrats. She created passion in both groups, but she's just authentic, and she's got all that charisma. That's a really effective speech.
That's interesting. Let's go back to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. We're talking about persuasive speeches you might have heard the last couple of weeks in the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Which one stood out to you? Again, our number 816-235-2888 and our email address updatedate@kcur.org. Richard from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My favorite speech was former President Clinton. And in part, it's because, I mean, I think he's as good as he ever was at speaking. But in part, I've heard it explained, he talks like he's talking to one person. Just like you're sitting at a table or at a cafe and having a conversation with one person. But he also takes the time to explain things. And he's really good at it. And so instead of confusing people, he comes across clearly and with as few words as possible, he gets his point across. But just the fact that he's willing to explain things in the first place, and so many politicians, in my opinion, Democrats in particular, aren't willing to make the case for whatever their policy or whatever they're trying to explain. And if you take it as an example that when he was talking about Paul Ryan's Medicare cuts, and he said, you know, you got it. He said, takes a lot of brass to blame another guy for doing this. What do you say? Takes a lot of brass for blaming another guy for what you did. And he did it. Any other politician would have taken 3 or 4 or 5 sentences to say that same thing, would have lost everyone. Bill Clinton did it in 10 or 11 words. And it was one of the hit sentences of his whole speech. But I just think he's like a lesson in public speaking. Less is more, and talk. It doesn't matter if you're talking to a million people, 100,000, or 10 people around a conference table, and you're giving a presentation. talk to him like you're talking to one person, and that's what he does so well.
Yeah, Richard, very good comments. And this idea of less is more, is Richard making a good point there?
Oh, I think he's making a very good point about Bill Clinton. I'm not sure about the less is more.
Mm.
His speech went a lot longer than it was planned to go.
He broke through that primetime local news hour pretty cleanly.
He did. Yeah. He was awfully good. I think another factor in this is networks don't want to cut off a former president. Maybe people are more willing to listen longer to a former president who had such good job creation because, you know, he's very, very good. He is not the only – the president's awfully good at explaining things too. My only qualm is I'm not sure that complicated explanations work for many undecided voters.
Was he complicated in his explanations?
He wasn't complicated if you're kind of up to date on following public policy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not, and you should look, people should look at the Pew Center website because it has a poll basically where people fill out what they know about public issues.
Mm-hmm.
And public knowledge of the issues is awfully low.
Yeah. You know, he struck me as so interesting because he struck me as gambling in a certain sense, Robin, because a lot of times, several times in that speech, he would say, now, listen to me. I'm not done talking. You know, listen to my explanation here, sort of saying the next few minutes are going to be me explaining to you what this policy is all about. And it struck me as kind of risky to sort of say, hey, sit back. I'm not done. I'm going to explain stuff to you, and you better sit back and enjoy it because that's what's going to happen here.
Well, I think that's exactly right.
But it worked, apparently.
It
for
does.
A lot of people.
I mean, I'm just remembering his previous convention nomination acceptance speech where the big applause line was in conclusion.
That was back in, what, 88, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
When he got ridiculed. Even Jay Leno brought him on, or somebody brought him on one of the shows to
right.
say, you went on so long. What happened out there?
And this was very much like his States of the Union speeches, mm-hmm. which did not always get good reviews. But I do think Obama, the president did not want to do the defense of his record himself. Bill Clinton was the perfect person to do it because we were willing to listen more to Bill Clinton. And then Bill Clinton was, as the caller said, masterful in making you feel like he was speaking to every individual, very much like President Roosevelt apparently was.
And again, your point is that's an innate ability that he's able to pull that off.
Well, he's got innate abilities and he's worked at it, so he knows how to do it. You know, it's funny how folksy the Rhodes Scholar was that night.
Boy, he really was. You know, you do wonder, again, in connection with President Clinton and sort of these long explanations, have we lost the ability to listen to, you know, sophisticated, detailed messages here?
Well, I think there's some question about that. The president always gets the worst reviews when he talks about complex public policy. And that was also true in the campaign. I think that's the point Maureen Dowd is making, that we don't get the same feeling as we got in 2008. Well, it's one thing to say, yes, we can. It's another thing to say, here's how the healthcare system works.
Yeah, right.
And the healthcare system is complicated, and any sensible speech about it is going to be complicated.
Yeah.
But we don't as a people, we don't much like that. I think that's a real barrier for a politician who's trying to change things.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here about politically persuasive speeches we heard the last couple of weeks. We're still interested in knowing which speeches work for you, which ones fell short. 816-235-2888. And our email address again, updatedate@kcur.org. In our second half, we'll break down more of what Mitt Romney and Barack Obama had to say last week. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's conversation with jazz vocalist Karen Allison or our look at online flirting, you can find those in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, we talk with political scientist Sam Popkin on winning and keeping the White House. Well, this hour we're talking with Robin Rowland. He's a KU professor of communication studies. We're talking about the political conventions and good persuasive speeches that were given, some that fell a little bit short. Let's go to some phone calls here. Some folks been waiting a little bit. Dwight from Lee's Summit. Dwight, you're on Up to Date with Robin Rowland. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. It's a great show today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I've got a question about candidates who make mistakes and then seek, apologize to the public. I know with Todd Akin recently with his comments, he dropped significantly in the polls, and then he kind of went on a statewide apology tour and running commercials apologizing. And then two polls came out last week. One showed that he had regained within 1 point of Claire McCaskill, and then another poll showed that he was leading Claire McCaskill now, post-mistake, by 3 points. And I was curious how candidates really, if their apology tours are effective, and how the public reacts to a candidate that's made a mistake. And I can listen offline.
Yeah, Dwight, that's a great question. What about, have you seen Todd Akin's ad in which he looks in the camera and says, I'm sorry, basically?
I have not seen that particular ad, but I've studied a lot about apologia is the kind of speech where you defend yourself. And I think there are a couple things. First, if it's just a screw-up, it'll hurt you in the short term, but it won't do much more than that. Like President Obama famously saying that he'd been in all 57 states, something like that. The question is, if it seems to go more to your core of what you really believe, are you apologizing for something to get out of it, or are you apologizing because you really have changed your views? And I think President Clinton is the best example of that. In the Lewinsky scandal, until he finally just said, this is all my fault, it's my sin, only then were that public opinion turned dramatically for him. That's a kind of rhetoric called atonement, where you take responsibility for your actions and you demonstrate that you have changed. So I think the question about someone like Todd Akin is, how much do people think this was a screw-up, and how much do people think this really reflects an underlying worldview? And the other thing is, of course, where he is in polling in Missouri, relates to a very bad economy. And Claire McCaskill is, I think it's fair to say, not universally popular.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a bunch of different factors involved.
And a couple of polls, I guess, in fairness, have showed the Senator McCaskill up by 9 or 10 points, a couple of recent ones. So the polling is sort of bouncing all over the place here on Todd Akin and Claire McCaskill.
And money's going to be an issue. Can he still raise money?
That's a huge issue in that race. One big question we're looking at right now at the newspaper. Sherry from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on Up to Date. Sherry, good morning.
Good morning, Steve, and thanks for this program.
Great.
I just wanted to give a shout to Deval Patrick's speech. I thought it was logical and well-delivered, concise, and encouraged people to give Obama another 4 years.
Okay.
I thought he was just fabulous. He was much better than I've seen him before. He was really good.
Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tyler writes, "This my favorite speech was also former President Clinton's for all that has been mentioned, but also because he actually used math as a topic that a lot of people find daunting. I appreciated it because it helped express topics in detail. Even if he went long, I thought it was a pretty good speech."
I did too. I mean, he used the word arithmetic to really cut through everything else. It was a very effective speech.
Does he write his speeches? Do you have any feel for that?
Well, there was news reporting afterwards about how I'm sure he wrote it. He probably had help. But then he rewrote it. And apparently a lot of what he did was somewhat off the cuff, which I think, that's the other side of authenticity, is you have enough trust to go off script. And that will lead to very good things happening. It occasionally will lead to very bad things happening.
And it leads to life, hell on earth for the teleprompter,
the
guy who's got to try and keep up with
whoever
the president is in his speech at that time.
Well, there's a famous story about Clinton, how good he was, that he went to give a State of the Union, and they had the last year's speech. And he
on the teleprompter.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so he leans up and tells the vice president this, Al Gore, and he did the first, 17, 18 minutes from memory.
Yes.
That's extraordinary.
That was an extraordinary moment, and he did pretty well when he had to do it, too, it sounds
he
like.
Did. He
yeah.
did.
Yeah, okay. Let's go to Nathan from Leawood. Nathan, you're on Up to Date.
I just wanted to speak in praise of Elizabeth Warren, who is the Senate candidate from Massachusetts. Obama had picked her to be the consumer finance chair, and she didn't really get a chance to speak about how the banking industry is really against the consumer, but she was very, very effective in expressing her points. So
yeah.
That's all I had to say.
Yeah, thanks, Nathan. What did you think of Elizabeth Warren?
I thought Elizabeth Warren was very good, but of course they immediately followed, or maybe it was before her, with the Costco executive, because they are afraid of being characterized as anti-business.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think Elizabeth Warren's argument is that effective regulation of the banks is good for business, but it is also easy to spin that as being against business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the Obama campaign was very careful to pair that with an explicitly pro-business message.
Tracy writes us this at UpToDate@KCUR.org. You can also call us 816-235-2888. We're looking for your recommendations for good speeches, persuasive speeches that you heard last week. And Tracy writes this, I was pretty much blown away by how direct, brutal, and powerful John Kerry's speech was. My boyfriend and I were watching it together, and I had to ask him, did Kerry have this much bite in his own presidential campaign? Tracy, the answer is no, by the way. And he agreed with me that this was a side of Kerry we hadn't seen yet.
That's exactly right. It reminded me of Kerry's speech in 1971 when he was a leader of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, mm-hmm. a very, very famous speech which had the same kind of passion. And maybe other than Bill Clinton's reference to arithmetic, the best line of the Democratic Convention was, ask bin Laden if he's better off than 4 years ago.
And that's the line I put in my column on Saturday. That line just brought the convention, just blew it apart. It was such an effective line, I thought, because Republicans hammering Democrats effectively in some ways with this age-old question, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?
And Kerry's an example of how a candidate has to say authentically who they are. If he had if he had just demanded to speak as who he is, he might have won in 2004. The same thing happened to Al Gore, but more dramatically in 2000.
You know, we talked just a couple of minutes ago, Robin, about this idea, you know, do these guys write these speeches or not? And you said Clinton had some help. Would your guess be that perhaps a speechwriter prepares a first draft to at least get the train moving, and then the candidate or the principal in this case, like Bill Clinton, would then swoop in and then craft it to his or her own liking?
In the best speechwriting offices, the speechwriters are essentially channeling the principal. So they will research things that the president or who has said in the past. So Reagan speechwriters always tried to be channeling Reagan. Jon Favreau does the same thing with the president, who, like Reagan, especially in the first term, is very involved in the speechwriting process.
That's interesting.
I think he apparently drives people crazy by rewriting until the last moment.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, he's like the early Reagan.
That's interesting. Let's go to Daniel from Kansas City, Kansas. Daniel, thanks for holding on. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to voice my disappointment with the weight that's placed on a speaker's ability to control themselves in a highly scripted, highly controlled situation. You know, Amy Goodman couldn't even speak to a number of people at the Republican National Convention. And when they do have debates with one another, they've eliminated the townhouse speakers. They've created a barrier for people to actually voice dissent or give them questions that are hard for them to answer, and so for them to, you know, successfully jump through the hoops that are at a low height seems, you know, disappointing. That people would say, "Oh, good job, you did something that was very easy, and had very little disappointment, very little opposition with."
Right, I hear you, Dan.
I'll take my comment off the air.
Yeah, thank you for the call.
I think the underlying point that the debates are better when you have real clash of ideas is exactly right. Now, I think the thing to recognize is that candidates can always dodge questions no matter how hard the question is.
Yeah.
I mean, they've done a lot of work on that. The thing that's harder to dodge is when your opponent makes a counterargument. And that's why I think the best debate formats have encouraged candidates to make an initial statement, and then the other person makes an initial statement, and then they go back and forth and make counterarguments. There's quite a bit of evidence that in 1980, the debate format was like that, and Reagan was quite good in that format, much better than people expected him to be. I remember having bought into the stereotype of Reagan as an actor. I was shocked by how good Reagan was, and it convinced me immediately that this guy was really on top of things. And that's the kind of format format they always try to do with when Jim Lehrer is the host.
Yeah.
The town hall, it's good and bad because it involves ordinary people, but there is a chance for kind of random things to happen, as when President George H.W. Bush got the question from a person who asked how the budget deficit was affecting him personally. And Bush was befuddled by the question because it wasn't really affecting him. And he didn't realize the questioner was really asking about the state of the economy.
Right.
And in that instance, Bill Clinton, who's a much better politician, looked great. And George H.W. Bush, who I think the consensus now was a pretty doggone good president, looked out of touch. The other famous moment when he looked at his watch, and I always say to people that either means he was bored or he wondered what time it was. It's hard to tell.
And it's a big mistake. You coach candidates never look down at the
well,
watch.
Well, yeah, and never do anything that can be perceived as disrespectful. Again, when Al Gore, the heavy sighs in the first debate, in 2000, if that had not happened by itself, that, you know, it was a close, very, very close election, that might have been enough that he would have won.
Oh, that's interesting. Even something as subtle and as seemingly a little deal like a sigh.
Nixon's famous 5 o'clock shadow in 1960.
There you go. Those things swing voters.
They do.
Okay. Let's go to Elaine from Kansas City, Missouri, with a question about Emanuel Cleaver's very energetic speech. Elaine, go ahead.
Well, I found Congressman Cleaver's speech to be truly exciting, and I was kind of sorry that it was placed where it was because it was an inspirational speech, not so much on information, but it certainly did fire up the troops, and it's the kind of speech that I think you know, gets people out into the streets, registering voters and that type of thing. And so I thought that I thought he was badly placed. He should have been much later in the day and much closer to prime time, if not in prime time, because he was phenomenal. And I was so proud to have him as my congressman.
That's interesting. Elaine, I wish we had a clip from that speech to play because he was really revved up. I guess one question might be, was he too revved up, Robin? Too excited in the moment, I guess, in a way.
Well, he's preaching to the saved. He's preaching to the base. He's just awfully good at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his background, but he's just plain good at it.
Beth writes us this about Cleaver's speech. Unfortunately, I thought Representative Cleaver lost a chance to really communicate the gridlock and premeditated obstruction by the Republicans to allow jobs bill, judge appointments, etc., to both affect the president and congressional elections. While his presentation was authentic to him, I've also heard him speak in a more reserved manner so that rather than watching, one can really listen. He is speaking to, hopefully, a broad spectrum of people and culture, not preaching to the choir. So two sides of Emanuel Cleaver there.
Well, he's very good at what he's doing. I mean, but the president for the African-American vote wants to, you know, get turnout as high as he can. But there are not many undecided voters there. And so that's why, you know, they have Bill Clinton give the long primetime speech, because Bill Clinton's uniquely qualified to reach especially white working class voters.
And Cleaver's situated to energize inner city voters, black voters, get folks to the polls.
It is a tragedy that we still view things in race that way.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to reach white working class voters, you know, that's a place the president has had a lot of problems. And, you know, race is still an issue.
That's interesting. Let's go to Mark from Olathe. Mark, you're on Up to Date. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. You have a great show going today. Thank you.
Thank you.
I didn't see Ann Romney's speech. I saw Michelle Obama's. My sophomore in high school son saw both. When I asked him to compare the two, his comment was that Michelle Obama delivered a speech at about the 12th grade level, whereas Ann Romney delivered one at about a 5th grade level. And I don't mean to, I'm not really editorializing here, but this is a question. You've been talking about preaching to the choir and reaching out to your base. Was that scripted, or was it just an indication of their ability to speak to an audience?
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Michelle Obama's speech is very similar in broadly thematic ways to the 2008 speech. I think she clearly has either wrote it or heavily was involved in the process. Ann Romney's speech, the themes I thought were effective, but it did have the feel of something that was more consultant-driven. She's trying to humanize her husband. Mm-hmm. I thought the most effective line was when she talked about the storybook marriage, but the storybook she read don't include MS,
yeah,
for example. I thought that was very effective.
Like breast cancer, I think,
that's
too.
Right, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Well, I mean, and the one thing that I came through, I did not think the text itself was as effective. I do think her love for her husband comes through.
Yeah, which matters.
It does matter. It's more important in this instance because we don't know Romney as well, and his favorability is a lot lower than the president's. And he does have a tendency to say things off the cuff, like the time he said, well, I have a couple of Cadillacs, or the time he said that he knew a lot of NASCAR owners, not drivers, yeah, that come across as things that ordinary people wouldn't say or do because he's very wealthy. I don't think wealth is the issue. I think it's how he comes across.
I thought both those speeches by the women were just very, very good.
I did too.
And in a way, in a sense, it's unfair because they're not the candidates, and yet now it's become part of our ritual at political conventions to hear from the wives, and they've got to perform and do a good job, or their husbands, in these cases, are in trouble.
I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. It just seems like it's the expectations have gone pretty high.
And if it doesn't go well, think the long kiss with Al Gore and Tipper in 2000. If it seems staged, it hurts you. And of course, this is just noise.
Was that staged in your mind?
I think a lot of people thought it seemed staged. And the one line in Ann Romney's speech that had that, when she yells out, I love women, and that it did have that, mm-hmm, that not really authentic feel to it.
We're talking about politically persuasive speeches that were given at the recent political conventions, both Republican and Democratic. 816-235-2888. Our guest is Professor Robert Rowland. He's a professor of communication studies at KU. He goes by Robin. Let's go to Ken here from Overland Park. Ken, you're on Up to Date. Good morning. You there, Ken? He wanted to talk about John Kerry's speech. Let's go to Bill from Lawrence. Bill, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I love your program. It's
great.
Thank
you, sir. Thank you.
I'd like to ask the professor, why don't the, particularly the Democratic candidates, talk about history? Don't they realize that from 1930 to 1940, the unemployment rate was above 12%? And it took that long. If we hadn't had World War II, we might still be in a depression. And the other issue I'd like to bring up is every time we have a businessman in the Oval Office, they foul things up. I'm referring to Herbert Hoover and George Bush.
Well, I think the point about history is very well taken, but political rhetoric is more about broad narrative themes that involve history. And for the last 30 years, kind of the dividing line has been which party has kind of rhetorical ownership of the American dream. And Ronald Reagan had a very individualistic narrative of by your bootstraps, government should get out of the way. And President Obama's contrasting narrative, which I thought was throughout all the convention, he called it citizenship. It's really a communitarian vision of the American dream, that we're stronger when the community helps each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the historical argument, is whether we're better off with individuals pulling themselves up or we're better with a community creating the preconditions that help individuals fight. And that's the level, at the level of a narrative view of history, that's probably the single most important kind of defining point between the two parties in rhetorical terms.
And Bill, thank you for the phone call. When you talk about the importance of narrative, Robin, you're talking about what? What does that mean in layman's terms?
Well, narrative. The American dream is a myth in the sense of a fundamental story, not a false story. And it is probably, along with American exceptionalism, those are our two, and they're heavily interrelated, our two most important political narratives. And by the way, despite the fact that you'll hear conservatives say the president is always attacking America, the president often weaves American exceptionalism into his own rhetoric. He concluded his book, The Audacity of Hope, by talking about how he took a run on the mall at night when he was a senator and often would end up at the Lincoln Memorial. And I believe the last line of the book is, "I am filled with love for my country." Hmm. So the president is off. That's not the stereotype, but that's the facts. And so it's really the command of those two narratives is really important in American politics, because those narratives are what underlie a lot of our values and a lot of our ideologies, our arguments. And who controls that? Reagan controlled it for a long time, but Obama in 2004 represented a real shift.
Thomas writes this, "Speeches are only important if they change the narrative to your position." Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right. That's why Obama's 2004 speech, like Reagan's inaugural, is so important, because it changed the narrative in a fundamental way.
Okay. Pat in Kansas City, Kansas writes this, "I found Sister Simone Campbell's 6-plus-minute speech very effective, especially when she spoke of President Obama's health care reform as part of my pro-life stance and the right thing to do." I guess there. Let's go to Victoria from Overland Park. Victoria, you're on the program. Good morning.
Great show. Yes, I wish Elizabeth Warren would have talked about a few people she met who had gotten jobs, so we could focus on the, you know, yes, we're doing better, instead of everyone she talked to had a horrible job loss. And then the surprise was the governor from Montana, I think Schweitzer.
Yes.
His contrast with his excellent success and the specifics with which he achieved it compared to Romney's governorship, I thought that was really inspiring, and he was so energizing and entertaining.
He was great.
And that's interesting, because he was the surprise of the 2008 convention, I think. He came from out of nowhere, and people were like, who's Brian Schweitzer? Now we haven't really heard of him since.
Again, some people just have the rhetorical skill, and he has both passion and authenticity, and it really comes through.
I think
His record was amazing. So thanks for a great show.
Thank you, Victoria. I think Governor Sebelius brought him out to Washington Days in Topeka a couple of years ago, right after that speech, to speak when he was hot on the national scene. And I haven't seen him or heard from him since.
Well,
so much for great speeches sometimes.
Well, you're right. And Montana, it's a long way away for a lot of people. And, you know, not very many voters in the national scheme of things.
Well, Robin, thanks so much for your time today.
It's been great.
Gave us a lot to think about. I'm sure glad you came over. Thanks very much. That's Robin Roland. He's a professor of communication studies at KU. You can learn more about our guests and get more information about our show at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, political scientist and author Sam Popkin talks about winning and keeping the White House. Today's show was produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.